Lisboa, Bruxelles, Berlin, Warsaw.
This podcast has been produced in cooperation with Euronet Plus, the leading radio network for EU news.
But this podcast would not be possible without the incredibly generous support of our amazing listeners who donate a little bit each month at patreon.com/Europeans podcast. Hello and welcome to the very first episode of the Europeans in 2026. We're here with three of us today.
Ooh.
Perhaps it's a sign of all that energy bubbling inside of us for the new year. I'm Dominic in Amsterdam, just about, considering the snowpocalypse that's happening here made the entire national transport system go down for a few days. I'm joined by Katie Lee in Paris.
Hello.
Hi, Katie. And Kat Slazlo in, actually, I don't know where you are. Where are you?
I'm in Sicily. It's lovely here. 17 degrees, a light winter sun.
Oh, way to rub it in.
I'm feeling particularly jolly because I've had like a canola every single day and I hiked Mount Etna, so I'm feeling very different than you guys.
Dominic, where's the button to eject cats from this call?
Yeah.
If it's any consolation, I've got a light case of bronchitis too.
Oh, okay. That makes me feel better because all my new year energy was just like sapping out of me quickly.
I've actually been quite enjoying the snow. Sorry to say that, Dominic. I've just been playing in it.
No, snow is absolutely wonderful. I love how it like turns our lives upside down, except for the fact that if you're trying to get from London to Amsterdam by train, as I was yesterday, it's really, really not fun.
You had an epic journey while I was playing with snowballs and enjoying the sight of normally uptight Parisians also throwing snowballs. It's been fun here, but we're getting to the slushy stage now. So people are going back to complaining about it and just being miserable Parisians. It's what we do. But anyway, I've been very grateful for the snow because it's provided a bit of respite from global politics. 2026 has really thrown us in at the deep end, huh?
My God.
It really has. And we're going to start this year with an interview with one of our favourite European analysts. Alberto Alemano is back on the show later on. And he's going to be helping us take stock of where the continent is at in 2026. It's going to be one of those broad-ranging interviews where we zoom out and look at the challenges that Europe might face this year and how prepared Europe is to deal with them. That's coming up later on in the show. But first, it's time for Good Week, Bad Week, without me because of the snow. Thank you, Kat, for stepping in.
Most welcome.
Is this the first ever Good Week, Bad Week to come to us from Sicily?
I think it is, yeah.
Oh, well, I'm annoyed that it's not me providing the Sicilian end of things, but you'll do.
It's so amazing here. I know that you've told me that you cried at breakfast once while you were here. I've had no teary breakfasts yet.
You
but
will.
But Etna, which was like the main thing I was excited to see other than my lovely friends who are hosting me. She started exploding as I was on my way here. And I just think it's so amazing that there's a live volcano here. And just, it's so magic. And I drove to Etna and then we met this random woman. And like the first woman we spoke to, she was like, I've lived here all my life. I couldn't live anywhere else. It's mesmerizing. Look at the lava. And it was just really, really amazing.
Can you put a lavery picture on our Instagram?
I can. I don't have a picture of the lava myself, though, but I will absolutely share it. There's an amazing array of pictures.
Nice.
All right. Maybe we should move on to all kinds of deep and dark policy. Good week, bad weeks, Katie.
Let's
start with you, Katie. Who has had a good week?
I am going to cheat maybe more than I have ever cheated in Good Week, Bad Week and say that I hope we're going to look back at last week as a good week for Bulgaria. Can I do that?
Make the case.
Okay, so I am going to give this very tentative good week to Bulgaria because as of the 1st of January, Bulgaria is a member of the Eurozone. Congratulations, Bulgaria.
Oh, big news.
Am I right in thinking that you have quite a strong memory of the day that Spain join the Euro when you were a kid?
I do, yeah. It was my first New Year's in Spain. And I just vividly remember like going down after midnight to a cash machine to get out the new money. And there was like all of this art made out because the pesetas had the coin with a hole in it so you could make jewelry out of it.
Ah, yeah.
And then we went down and we got cash out. And I remember vividly that my neighbor and my parents got out a 200 euro note. And I've just never seen that note ever.
Yeah, I was going to say, does that still exist?
It was like the symbol of the transition for me. And then I just only saw it in... I actually saved up that summer for Monopoly Euro edition.
Oh, yeah.
Paris is the most fancy city, unsurprisingly.
Yes, sir.
So that night and Euro Monopoly are the only places I've ever seen a 200 euro note.
Well, I hope that you will see one again one day, Kat. Maybe in Bulgaria, because it is the 21st country in Europe to start using our shared currency. It is the end of the lev, which is the currency that they've been using there since 1881. And the reason I'm feeling so cautious about giving it a good week is that Bulgarians are super divided about whether they support changing the currency. The opinion polls have basically been 50-50.
Okay, 50-50, pretty tight. It's amazing how many things are 50-50. Mm-hmm. What are the main arguments that the pro-camp and the anti-camp have put forward?
If you look at the pro-camp, it is broadly made up of younger people, people with higher education, people who live in cities, business owners. Those people tend to think that Bulgaria joining the euro is a good thing. And the arguments are kind of obvious. So if you are a business, like let's say a food business that imports food from other European countries, being part of the euro makes your life a lot easier. Like you're not going to have any costs anymore related to dealing with exchange rates in getting your supplies to Bulgaria. It makes investments from other European countries a lot easier. So people are hoping there's going to be an influx of foreign investment to Bulgaria now. If you are a Bulgarian who travels a lot, your life is going to be easier now because you can go to 20 other countries just using your normal bank card without even thinking about it. Mm. And if you work in tourism, you might now be feeling optimistic that more European tourists will think of Bulgaria as an option for their vacation because it's now that little bit easier. So that's the pro camp. The anti-camp tends to be older, more rural, less educated. Mm. And some of the arguments are emotional, which is understandable. You know, people have used this currency for their whole lives. And especially for older people, it is a part of their national identity. I do wonder if that's going to be less and less the case with currencies in general, because younger generations in large parts of the world just don't use coins and banknotes as part of their everyday life in the way that they used to. But yeah, in Bulgaria, they've tried to address that emotional national identity issue by putting super Bulgarian things on the new coins. Things that were on the old coins, in fact. Mm. So the 1 euro coin has St. Ivan on it, Bulgaria's first hermit.
Ooh, I'm just looking him up now.
Yeah, he lived in the mountains in the hollow of a tree, apparently. Sounds like something you might do, Kat.
I want to be alone.
I should mention that pro-Russian parties and pro-Russian online accounts have been really pretty active in pushing arguments against Bulgaria joining the euro, which makes sense, right? Bulgaria is already an EU member. It's a NATO member. It's in the Schengen zone. This is one of the last things that this country can do to knit itself closer to Europe and distance itself even more from Russia, which of course it was very close to under communism. Some of the arguments pushed by these pro-Russian groups have been totally false, claiming, for example, that Bulgarians' bank savings are going to disappear overnight as a result of joining the euro. Mm. But some of the arguments have maybe got a little bit more to them. Bulgarian nationalists have argued, for example, that joining the euro represents a loss of sovereignty. And that is sort of true, and it sort of isn't. Like, there are really big and serious things that you lose the power to do if you don't have your own currency. Fundamentally, you cannot control your own interest rate anymore, which is something that you might really want to be able to do if a recession hits. Mm. And that was something that a lot of economists say would have been really helpful in southern European countries like Greece when they were trying to get out of the financial crisis. At the same time, this is kind of technical, but Bulgaria has actually already been subject to the policies of the European Central Bank since 2020 when it joined this really fun thing called the European Exchange Rate Mechanism.
Really sexy name once again.
You love it. And now that it's got the euro, Bulgaria actually gets to have a say on making that policy, which you could argue is actually something that gives them more power, more sovereignty. Apart from sovereignty, another major thing that people are worried about is that joining the euro might make inflation worse. And inflation in Bulgaria is really pretty bad right now. Food prices went up 5% year on year in November, which is more than double the average in the eurozone. So it's a really real concern that this could get even worse.
Oh, yeah, the inflation argument feels particularly relevant right now. There are lots of countries that have joined the eurozone over time. Can we learn anything from them about whether all of these things are likely to happen in Bulgaria? Like, did prices go up in other countries after they joined the euro?
They did, but not long term and not in a big way. Typically less than 1%, according to economists. And that's partly because, you know, switching currency does have some costs for businesses. In countries that have previously joined the euro, we've also seen this phenomenon of shops taking advantage of the switch to round their prices up slightly. Yeah. And people really remember that.
I vividly remember the 100 pesetas, the 100 pesetas shops, which is like where you could get all your cheap sponges and stuff. Mm-hmm. And then they went to 1 euro, which was like twice as much or something.
Right, exactly. And this is something that really sticks in people's minds, like in various different European countries that have joined the euro previously. Long term, it has to be said, there isn't any real evidence that joining the euro increases your inflation. Mm. And in fact, it seems to have helped to keep inflation down in the long term across countries that use it. Although I appreciate that it really might not feel like that right now. In Bulgaria, they've put watchdogs in place to try and stop businesses from doing that. But yeah, this worry over inflation, it does come up a lot when people are asked why they're against the euro. The final thing that comes up a lot is just how chaotic Bulgarian politics is right now. So back in December, yet another Bulgarian government fell. And I say yet another because, oh my God, Bulgarian politics makes French politics look completely sane and normal, frankly. The country has had 7 elections in 5 years. Oof. And it looks like they're going to have another one because the most recent government has just been chased out by mass protests over corruption, which is rampant. Mm. Is it a good idea to introduce a new currency when you have a political vacuum and it's not really clear who is going to be running the country in the months to come? The president has asked the parties in parliament to try to find some kind of workable coalition. But right now, that doesn't seem very likely, which means that new elections are on the horizon. And, you know, even the outgoing government was divided on whether joining the euro was a good idea. So it doesn't feel like there is a united, strong political elite that is in place to manage this pretty big change.
Well, that all sounds incredibly worrying.
It does. But the reason that I'm reasonably hopeful that this will be remembered as a good week for Bulgaria joining the euro is that the transition so far has been really pretty uneventful. Bulgaria's currency was already pegged to the euro, which means there really don't seem to have been any dramatic changes to the Bulgarian economy in the immediate term. And there are various measures in place to try and make things feel as smooth as possible. You can actually still use the old currency until the end of the month, and shops will display prices in both currencies until the summer to help people make the mental calculation. The other big thing that makes me feel hopeful is just how positive the attitudes are of people living in countries that have had the euro for years now. 83% of Europeans support single currency. Huh. And that number has gone up over the last couple of decades in pretty much every country, including in countries like Greece and Spain and Portugal.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's also really not common. Like almost everything, it feels like we're all 50-50 on everything. 83% is really rare.
The one thing that we're not 50-50 on, the euro. Who'd have thought it? What is especially hopeful for Bulgaria is that the same kinds of demographic groups that are particularly anti-euro in Bulgaria right now, so older people, less educated people, across Europe, those are the groups that have had the biggest increases in the number of people deciding, you know what, this whole euro thing has actually worked out okay. So I think that's a good sign that maybe in the long term, the same thing could happen in Bulgaria. I don't know. I don't want to make it sound like this is an amazing risk-free thing that is going to make Bulgarians richer overnight. Like we all saw what happened in Europe before 2008. Like all of this money flowed from richer Eurozone countries like Germany to poorer ones like Greece. And it contributed in a massive way to those countries having property bubbles. So it's a big part of why those countries experienced so much more pain during and after the financial crisis. Bulgaria is one of the poorest countries in the EU, and some people are hoping that joining the euro could be some kind of magic bullet. It is pretty clear that it won't be, especially if it's not accompanied by reforms and an end to this corruption that has brought so many people out onto the streets. So yeah, it's a good week, I hope, but a week that comes with quite a lot of risks. Who has had a bad week?
This week, I am giving bad week to Greek students, or at least the 308,000 of them who have lost their student status.
Oh, that's a lot of people.
That is a lot of people. On December the 31st, 2025, very festive date, the Greek government removed status for students that they consider to be inactive, which amounts to about half of the student population.
Wow.
And they say this is just the first step.
Oh my goodness. Okay, so this is students they consider to be inactive. I'll come to a second, I guess, about like why they want to do this. But first of all, how did they decide who they could describe as being inactive?
Yeah, so there's not a ton of international reporting about this, but from what I can tell, it's the government who makes the rules on who is and isn't inactive. And then that is combined with the university's own records. Mm-hmm. And basically, it is all the students who are enrolled in four-year programs and, according to the government, haven't registered for any classes or done any exams since before 2017.
Okay.
But this new policy has seen a wave of outrage, and critics say that it discriminates against students who have to work alongside their studies to pay for their lives, or who have to take care of family or friends who are ill or who have health issues themselves. Mm. What didn't help the outrage of the people with that kind of critique is that a day after the announcement, an amendment was added that students are free to enroll in private universities however they like, which, incidentally, Greece's constitution says that universities should be public. But controversially, the current government allowed foreign universities to come and open up branches in Greece, which are private and paid for earlier in its term. And so some people are calling it a move from the government to promote private paid-for universities and weaken state universities as well as students' access to them.
Okay. This is a really interesting one, because when you first tell me, like, you know, we want to take people that haven't been to classes since like 2017 off the books, that seems kind of reasonable to me. But yeah, like, as you say, there are people that presumably take breaks from their studies to go and look after relatives or because they have to work, like all kinds of reasons. Why does the government want to do this? Like, why does it seem like an important thing to do right now? What is the benefit to them?
Yeah, I mean, it's complicated. The main argument I've seen is that the government wants to improve the credibility of these university programs. Mm-hmm. And the Liberal Conservative Minister of Education, Religion and Sports, Sofia Zakaraki, she argues that it's also about reducing state funding that is inflated by what the government is calling eternal students. And they argue that these people are keeping their student status without actually doing anything for decades. They also argue that they do give second chances to students who can prove serious reasons, and that lots of people have made use of that. So, as we said, people who work or who are taking care of ill family members. And according to former guest of the show, Nick Malkoutsis, it's not just a battle about policy, but it's really a symbolic battle about autonomy and the purpose of tertiary education. Mm-hmm. So more broadly, critics argue that these so-called eternal students don't cost anyone anything, and they deserve the right to go back to education even after life intervenes. Now, it was hard for me to get to the bottom of, like, to what extent this policy is discriminatory. I did see a fifth-year student from the Electrical Engineering University named Dimitris Daskalakis, who is on the board of the HMMY Student Association. And he told press that it was a deliberate tactic to announce these measures during academic holidays, that the government has done this before. And he argues that choosing how you spend your time, including your free time, and reflecting critically on how universities operate is a fundamental part of being a student.
But, like, would it actually save the government any money to just cut the number of official students on the books? Like, does it have any impact on their budget in a real way?
I couldn't find any concrete numbers on either government spending per student or what this mass expulsion would lead to in terms of government savings or the impact on the group who have lost student status.
If you have like a student card in Greece, do you get like a ton of benefits? Is there like a reason you might want to keep your...
I did see that student status comes with various things like discounts that come with your student card. You know, like when you walk into a place and then you can go to museums for free. Mm-hmm. And I also saw that there's a different type of welfare. So like if you need any kind of welfare support, then you're in a stronger position if you're a student. Mm-hmm. I did have to think back to... Like, I couldn't find how long Greece's prime minister or minister of education took to do their own degrees, just that they studied quite extensively. But I will say, I actually moved to the Netherlands to study in large part because at the time I was living in Spain where youth unemployment was like 60-70%. Mm-hmm. And in the Netherlands, the government still gave this monthly stipend to students. So I'm part of this generation of students in the Netherlands who did their bachelor's when student basic income had just been cut by about half. Mm. And then it was cancelled and turned into just a debt shortly after my first degree. And while I understand that it's like a bit outrageous to be receiving student benefits for like 15 years while going backpacking in Peru, which is definitely something that some people were doing, some people were delayed in their degrees because of much harder things, like including international people. I remember there were, you know, people dealing with mental health issues, people dealing with really difficult situations politically happening in the countries that they were coming from. Mm-hmm. And then it was a bit hard to swallow that a lot of these policies were being written and defended by politicians in their 60s who basically did exactly that. Like they studied for an unimaginably long time while getting this basic income from the government. For example, Mark Rutte, the former prime minister, and his minister of education, they both did their bachelor's for like 7 years, and they had these other interviews where they were like, oh, I just got to reflect on democracy. And then, you know, this rolls around and they wanted to punish students who took a fourth year in their 3-degree university by raising tuition by 3,000 euros a year.
That is so annoying.
Very annoying. And I mean, it's really quite amazing that people who studied between 2015 and 2023 in the Netherlands are like tens of thousands of euros in debt. And the ones who studied before just aren't.
Yeah, it's funny. I did all of my studies in the UK and all of the controversy around tuition fees for university studies in the UK, I was studying right in the midst of that.
Yeah.
And it was really the first policy I experienced as something that like had the power to create different classes of people just by the decision of a government. Yeah. So my brother studied just before me. He had free university studies. I was in the group that had to pay 3,000 a year. And that already felt unfair, you know, like I'm going to graduate with debt that my brother doesn't have. And then after me came this whole generation of people that have to pay 9,000 euros a year.
Oh, yeah, I remember that. That was the year after I started studying.
Right. Just graduating with like really colossal amounts of debt after that. So yeah, it was a strange kind of awakening for me that like these decisions have the power to really shape our financial status in big, big ways.
Yeah, it's massive. Like it knocks on now those people who have loads of debt have a much harder time getting a mortgage. So, mm-hmm. so it just carries on for the rest of your life. What I also noticed was I used to teach in a US university where obviously the education system has been like way more privatized. And I really noticed such a huge difference just teaching between the students who are having to like work 3 jobs to pay for their degree and the students who came from more comfortable economic backgrounds where they could just study. Mm-hmm. To the point where I started to like feel hesitant about how much homework to give. And I talked with my mentor at the time about it, that she was like, yeah, the more work you give outside of this class, the harder it is for different classes of people. Mm-hmm. So that was like a really very concrete moment where that kind of education policy was really impacting the way you can teach. All in all, I think it's safe to say bad week for the half of the Greek students who lost their student status. And we will be reading more to see if there are any more developments we should talk about on the show. Thank you so much to our Greek partners at Euronet Sky, as well as former guest of the show, Nick Malkoutsis, for helping me inform this story.
This podcast is a listener-supported operation. Now, we do have some funding for some of that operation from this radio consortium we mentioned up top, Euronet Plus, but that only covers some specific costs that we make, and it also only goes till the end of this year. So we really need listeners to say to themselves, I like what this podcast is doing. I think I'd like to keep it going. Maybe I'll throw them a little bit of cash each month to keep the show on the air. Are you possibly thinking that or something like that? Am I a mind reader in 2026? If so, please go ahead and do it at patreon.com/Europeans podcast. You can donate as little as €4 per month. I hope this isn't too pushy. In 2026, I'm trying to be more clear and direct. They're my two words of the year.
You're trying to be more Dutch and less British, in other words. Love that for you.
Exactly, yeah, but like in a kind way. But I feel like maybe I'm stumbling at the first hurdle and alienating all our potential supporters by asking them too forcefully for money. Anyway.
Completely unlikable.
No, too British. Don't think like that. Just be direct. Say, give us money, please.
Okay.
The really nice thing is that loads of people did sign up to support us over the holidays. Thank you so, so much. The amazing people we would like to give a shout out to this week are Kirills, Wattis, JK, Carol, David, Igor, Buttercup, Anastasia, Lini Pesto, Stefan, Pingolin, Jane, Benjamin, Adi, Ray, Mark, who is a longtime listener, never misses an episode. Mark, your subscription is a gift from your husband, Hans. Thanks, Hans.
Aww.
And a massive thank you also to Susanna, Ruthann, Jeroen and Tyne for increasing your donations.
Thank you all so much.
Thanks, guys. So this year was 3 days old, I think, when the United States launched an attack on Venezuela and captured its president. Trump has really wasted no time at all in getting 2026 off to a tumultuous start. You don't need us to tell you that all of this feels massive and unsettling. We don't know what the spillover effects of what's happening in Venezuela are going to be in this part of the world and in the world at large. Is Trump going to see that he's faced basically no consequences for taking over a foreign country and go after Greenland, which is, of course, an autonomous territory within the Kingdom of Denmark? Does Putin see this as giving him license to also go around launching yet more devastating invasions after Ukraine? Does Xi Jinping do the same and think, you know what, I might just help myself to Taiwan. This seems to be the done thing right now. Honestly, I don't know. I am looking at international politics right now and feeling a bit at sea, Kat. Are you also at sea?
No, I'm completely on top of it. No, of
okay.
course not.
You're on dry land.
No, I'm feeling rudderless as you are. I think actually like the longer I've been reporting on Europe with you, and also, I mean, just moving around, I really I've come to see how easy it is to form like a completely misinformed opinion that's actually quite harmful. And so my approach is usually now more and more to like really try and dig in and not pretend I know something about a place that I don't. But I mean, it's overwhelming. Like there's so many things to dig in and have a proper understanding of.
Mm-hmm.
With Venezuela in particular, as unreported as it is, so I haven't learned that much from like the news, but hundreds of thousands of Venezuelans have already fled Maduro's regime and the Chavez regime before that and come to Europe mm-hmm. over the past, yeah, I mean, decades, really.
Yeah.
So it's not something that we are completely suddenly finding ourselves connected with. It's something that's already been pretty present.
Yeah.
But it is one of the many things that is happening that you barely hear about in the news. And yeah, I'm also finding it incredibly difficult to keep up in a way that feels respectful.
Venezuela aside, 2026 feels like a kind of anxiety-inducing year because of a bunch of other things. We are still a continent at war and a continent fearing wider war at the hands of Russia.
Wider war.
Yay.
Miserable.
AI is taking over everything we do. That's another fun thing to think about. And climate change is still a thing that is happening, even though our politicians seem to be slightly distracted right now from doing anything about it.
Oh my God. I just couldn't have imagined, if I think about like learning about climate change when I was a teenager, that this is where we would be at this time.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, in 2025, it was confirmed by various experts, including the UN, that we steamed past the once upon a time legal maximum of 1.5 degrees planet heating, which like barely made the headlines. And
yeah,
you know, on many, many fronts, credibility around various human rights agreements once written in this continent is rapidly crumbling.
Yeah. I mean, suffice to say, there is a lot going on as we enter 2026. And I don't know about you, but I really need some help in making sense of what might lie ahead. I'm not asking for predictions. I'm asking for signposts and obvious things to look out for. And one person immediately came to mind when we were thinking about who we might call on to have this conversation with us. Alberto Alemano, he's a returning guest here at the Europeans, a familiar voice for those of you who've been listening for a long time. Alberto is a man who wears many hats. He is a professor of EU law at HEC Business School here in Paris. He is the founder of the Good Lobby, which tries to get activists more of a say in the European policymaking process. He's someone who can always be relied on to come at European politics from an angle that I haven't thought of. Mm. Like, he always says something that surprises me.
Definitely.
So I can't wait to hear what he has to say. He's also someone that apparently has limitless energy because he agreed to speak to us shortly after arriving in Tokyo, where he is teaching for a month, despite being horribly jet lagged. Let's give him a ring. This interview is brought to you in collaboration with our radio partners at Euronet Plus. Alberto, thank you so much for joining us.
Always good to speak to the Europeans.
We're always very happy to have you. 2026 seems to have gotten off to a very dramatic start as far as global politics is concerned, with the US removal by force of Venezuela's president. What do you make of the way that European leaders have reacted to this rather jaw-dropping move of Trump's?
Did they react at all? One might have expected sort of unanimous voice emerging out of this fact by saying, first of all, this is illegal. This is not the way you move forward. I think never in modern history has Europe confronted a threat quite like this one. We were told that Brexit was existential, then the euro crisis, then the migration wave. But if anything truly deserves that word existential, is what Europe faces in 2026, right? In 2025, Europe became the enemy. And despite this incredible opportunity which is given to us, which is stemming from the Venezuela operation and the ensuing renewed threat to invade or seize Greenland, our national political leaders, they cannot speak with one voice. So this is extremely frustrating, I think, for most Europeans. I think it's very difficult to understand how it is possible that when those red lines are clearly crossed, from both a European and international law perspective, our European leaders don't stand up and they don't say this red line has been crossed.
On a pragmatic note, though, are they not partly doing that at least because everyone is focused on peace for Ukraine and they're worried that, you know, pissing Trump off too much by saying, hey, you probably shouldn't have done that, might not be in their interest when it comes to Ukraine?
The calculus is clear, but in reality, this is very short-termist. And is also set to backfire because basically if Europe is not able to speak with one voice when its own territorial integrity is about to be breached, then it will be too late. So we are basically compromising on basic principles on the basis of an illusion that the US is still there to defend us.
I mean, looking specifically at Greenland, how much more nervous should the events in Venezuela make us about Trump's desire to take over Greenland?
I think regardless of whether this threat will materialize, the only fact that a NATO country like the US is currently challenging another NATO country member like Denmark and by ricochet, the entire European Union, per se represent a red line being crossed. Obviously, the NATO agreement and alliance would fall immediately because there would no longer be the trust needed to make it work, with enormous repercussions. Basically, the message America is giving is a free pass to Russia to continue doing what it's doing in Ukraine and potentially other former satellites with the Soviet Union, but also to China, a free pass on going to Taiwan and potentially going over the little islands on the Pacific vis-a-vis Japan. So that's the message and the new multipolar world that international relations scholars have been conceptualizing for some time, a world in which we enter into a zero-sum game where one region gains some territory and another region loses. And we are really departing from this idea of multilateralism in which we can all collaborate and cooperate, because if we do this, everybody can gain at the same time. Some they're going to gain more, some other a bit less, but this idea is really put into question.
And what do you think should be on European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen's to-do list in 2026?
So Europe could, first of all, and Ursula von der Leyen should suspend the trade agreement or trade deal it concluded with America. That's something that could be done. It should start encouraging countries to sell off US debt. It should extend membership to Greenland to become a member of the European Union. It should extend membership to Canada because there was some possible interest there. And all these actions belongs to Ursula von der Leyen prerogatives. She's the president of the European Commission, the only institution whose objective is to identify and promote the European public interest. And that's what I think Ursula von der Leyen legacy will be judged against.
Volodymyr Zelensky said in his New Year's address that the current peace deal on the table was 90% ready, which feels fairly optimistic in the grand scheme of things, even as the attacks from Russia continue. How hopeful are you that Ukraine might see peace in 2026?
It is true that these days we see that we are making advancement, but the real question remains, what are the security guarantees we can provide? We Europeans and others, including the UK, perhaps America, can guarantee to the Ukrainians. So will the Russian invasion of Ukraine become that precedent that will push other countries, starting from the US, to continue those kind of territorial breaches, or will rather become a precedent that has been contained? I think the jury is still out. We're only at the beginning of the year, but we see some developments suggesting that Ukraine is really the top priority.
We spent a lot of the last year vowing to get our act together as a continent when it comes to defense, and specifically being able to defend ourselves against further Russian attacks without American help. But yeah, we're not exactly agile right now. There is a lot to do before we can say that we are genuinely ready to fend off a Russian attack. Are you hopeful that even with everything else going on, there are concrete things that Europe is going to do this year to get us that little bit closer to readiness, given that all of the available intelligence suggests that Russia would be capable of attacking another European country after Ukraine in just a few years from now?
This is certainly the first time in modern European history in which the territorial integrity of Europe is threatened, not only from the East, but also from the West. So the threshold is basically there for Europeans to start doing what they keep saying, which is to basically create the conditions for defending themselves. And yet, I don't think we've reached that threshold. I'm getting quite dramatic here. I really think that that territorial integrity has to be breached somewhere. It could be on the East, meaning could be Finland or could be Estonia, not a Baltic country. It could be Greenland. But unless we go there, I don't think we're going to be seeing this quantum leap that will create the conditions that have always been necessary for European leaders to give up on sovereignty and deepen their integration. And more critically, even if that particular territorial breach should occur tomorrow or after tomorrow, we have never addressed the key question, which is who is going to take the command of that form of coordination of defense that somehow will have to be triggered. And we have realized, because in Europe we are too honest, we are self-inflicting this kind of diagnosis, and then we share it around, we even publicize it. We spend the last year telling everyone how weak we are in terms of infrastructure. So if we're going to be attacked on the West, we're going to be struggling to bring the army from the East to the West and vice versa, because those infrastructures are not working, are simply not there. We are very good at diagnosis, but we are very bad at acting upon those kind of analysis. And again, I think that the $6 million question for 2026 is, what would it take? What has to happen?
On the subject of what will it take, a lot of EU governments are gearing their defense budgets towards general disaster preparedness as well, and in particular climate disasters. And I'm wondering how you're expecting that to develop.
I think that's a very sensitive topic, because we have been witnessing in the past few months a major departure from major public interest objectives. The European Union has presented over 10 omnibus regulation packages. So they are basically simplifying standards when it comes to climate, when it comes to chemicals, when it comes to pesticides. And they are basically relaxing those standards in an incredible rollback in order to satisfy both the internal demand to unleash the European competitiveness, but also to satisfy the demand of the United States to enter the European market by complying with a less cumbersome standard. And this is basically self-defeating, because Europe is giving away the only power it really has, acting together by having common standards, common policies that are working. And Europe is giving away that power in order to somehow chase this idea that we are going to be able to transfer some of those resources to a variety of industries, including the defense industries, in order to chase America and China and other emerging economies. I don't think this is the right game for Europe to enter.
Mm-hmm. Something seems to be shifting in that the world is really talking about Europe as a unified actor. You know, there was this US national security strategy that was released at the end of last year, and it threw a lot of shade at Europe, you know, making out that we're this depraved continent that censors free speech, apparently, and we've lost sense of who we are because we've tragically let too many immigrants in. Anyway, this document slags us off as a continent. It treats us as one. And if we want to be a bit more optimistic about the state of the world, maybe it's kind of a good thing that we're being treated as one these days.
I've been saying this in the past few months, that there's never been a better time to be a European, because I really feel genuinely that it's probably the first time in the past 50, 60, 70 years in which the world is looking at us as a one political entity, as a one political actor. They are treating us as Europeans, not as Germans, Poles, Swedes, Slovenians, or Spaniards, or Portuguese, but because we are European, we are a thing. Suddenly, Europe has become a thing. It has become a thing because it represents an alternative model to systems that are so different than ours. It could be China, it could be Russia, it could be America this day. So it's paradoxical that our enemies and rivals see Europe as more threatening and powerful than the European themselves. We're an incredibly wealthy region. We have been growing as much as America, despite all this data suggesting that our productivity rate is low. Basically, America and Europe are economically equal. They are not so different. They spend 4% in defense. We spend 2% in defense. This is manageable. We can spend more, and we committed to spend more. And that's what keeps me awake at night, but also gives me hope that finally, despite all this reticence of our political leaders to come together and to act and to defend, there is today a majority of European citizens who are actually unsatisfied by the state of the world. They are very proud of what Europe still represents today. And so we are very close to that moment in which there will be a genuine bottom-up healthy demand for pan-European actions, pan-European conversations, which are the only ones that will allow us to advance instead of holding us back as they are today. We are incredibly close. The more Europe will be challenged, the more Europeans will feel more European.
Alberto always gives me something fresh to think about. Like, I really liked this point he made about how good Europeans are at diagnosing our weaknesses and then not necessarily acting on it.
Yeah. Oh, man. On the subject of New Year's resolutions, I've been talking a lot about, like, the critique that's true that you don't want to hear with my friends around me. And that felt very recognizable at a continental level.
Yeah, but at the same time, it is also really good to hear someone making a case for everything that there is to fight for, like everything we have to be proud of as Europeans, especially given the state of the world. And I think I needed to hear that. Like, I think I focus sometimes too much on the diagnosis bit.
The thing that really stuck with me in Alberto's interview is this sort of like strange thing of, on the one hand, Europe feeling important on the global stage, and on the other hand, being like, oh, little old us. Which is quite strange because we really are, you know, a collection of the richest countries in the world. And that really stayed with me of like, surely we could be covering some of these basic needs of people with that money.
Europe needs to own it more in 2026. There's a New Year's resolution for you. Anyway, always a pleasure to have Alberto on the show. He is a really, really great person to follow on social media if you are looking for zoomed out analysis on where Europe is at and Europe's place in the world. He's on LinkedIn, he's on Blue Sky, he's on Instagram, loads of different places. And on those platforms, he started fairly recently doing a series of videos that he calls European Question Time, 90-second clips, kind of giving his takes on where we're at. They're really worth checking out. We'll put the links in the show notes. I'm glad you're here, Katz, because you've been able to rescue both Dominic and me this week. Dominic, because he spent all of yesterday stuck on a bus, and me, because I'm sorry to tell you, listeners, I have nothing to recommend to you this week because I consumed zero culture over the holidays. Turns out that traveling with small children is not really that conducive to reading books or even watching television. And I love television. So I'm hoping to catch up on the snowy nights to come. But in my place, what have you got to recommend for us?
Yes, I've got two. I've got a fun holiday-fueled one, and then I've got a bit of a weird one.
Oh, I can't wait.
I'll start with a fun one, which is a song by Sicilian icon Rosa Balistreri, who is a Sicilian woman who was born in 1927, so she died in 1990. And she is quite an interesting character. She spent her childhood helping her alcoholic carpenter father instead of going to school. Wow. She was married to someone at 16 who was also an alcoholic, who she attacked after she thought that he had gambled their only daughter's dowry away. And then she turned herself into the police because she thought she'd killed him, but she hadn't.
Whoa.
She had all kinds of bouts in prison and all kinds of, yeah, wild stories. I really recommend that you read about her. She left to the mainland to work as a servant. And it was there that she started her artistic career in the 60s. So she was 40 years old at her first performance. So there's still time for us. And her voice is absolutely amazing. She's got a whole array of songs about what her friend, the author Leonardo Sciascia, calls the violent, tender, bittersweet ambiguities of Sicily. Mm. Her voice has like so many layers, and it's really, I was blown away when I heard it. And she sings about unemployment, about hunger, about discrimination, and about the violence against women. But she also sings about pride and dignity and indignance in Sicily. Mm. So yeah, I picked this song. It is called Curi Cavado Mio, which is Sicilian for Run My Horse. And there are many, many more songs that I will leave a link to in the show notes.
Sounds amazing. I can't wait to check her out.
Yeah, me too.
What's this other weirder recommendation you've got?
So my second one is the absolute dream that is my Spanish dentist.
Okay.
Cultural recommendations across Europe. Thanks, Katz.
This is a first for the Europeans.
Exactly. Keeping it diverse. So this isn't very scientific. It's based on my random interactions. But as you both know, I have had a wide array of cross-border medical escapades, and I just can't believe how much it varies per country. to give some context, I knocked out my front teeth when I was 7 years old, my first month living in Spain, on a very tooth-coloured marble floor. And what that means is I now have porcelain implants installed by a dentist in Barcelona. Mm-hmm. And they've been there since I was 18, so I kind of forgot they were there. But at the end of last year, I was eating a very powerful organic carrot and I knocked one of them out. And this was in Amsterdam. And so I thought, oh God. And the next morning, I spent like 4 hours bouncing between my Dutch dentist, my GP, a dental surgery department, and an implantologist. And they were all just like pointing at each other and almost acting indignantly, like, why would you expect me to know such things? I can't help you. I don't know who can. Leave me alone. You must go to this other office.
Oh, no.
To the point where I just put the dental surgery secretary on the line inside my GP's office. And then they started arguing with each other. And my GP was like, this is completely mad. Like, obviously she hasn't been registered at your practice, but she's sitting here with a tooth in her hand. Like, it can't be true that she has to wait here for 3 months for an intake. And the dentist was just like, we can't say how long it'll be until the intake. It'll be a few months. It'll cost like 2,000 euros.
2,000 euros? Like,
this is completely insane. So my GP at this point was quite sympathetic, but I walked out and I started crying and I called my Spanish dentist and they were just like, picked up 1 second, like, no way, no way whatsoever. And they were just like, hi, dear. Oh, that sounds stressful. We can see you tomorrow at 10, which was a Saturday.
Wow.
It'll be about 100 euros. Just send us the X-ray over WhatsApp to confirm. God. And it was like a 2 minute call. I mean, admittedly, WhatsApp, not the best for privacy, but I just couldn't believe it. So I decided to make a fun trip out of it. And I got in my van and I drove all the way to Barcelona via some very nice nature parks in France. And then my Spanish dentist reinstalled my tooth for like 100 euros within 2 days. Problem solved. They even massaged my face with rosemary oil at the end.
Stop it.
What like levels of service?
You can't make this up. So I'm not saying that this is representative of every Dutch dentist and every Spanish dentist, but it was a completely mad contrast. I had a similarly excellent experience with an Italian doctor on this trip. And it would be weird to tell you to go to my particular dentist in Spain for privacy reasons. And also because I know he really wants to retire, which is devastating news for me, but great for him. But if you're looking for cultural inspiration and you are lucky enough to be in a more affordable country, I highly recommend you just go to the dentist or something, just or like any kind of fundamental infrastructure, just to see what happens and report back to us.
Going to the dentist as a cultural recommendation, this is unheard of.
I can't wait to read your book about all the medical tourism you're doing across Europe.
That is a good book.
Medical immigration, I would say. It's not tourism.
Well, thank you for that, Kat. A most unusual recommendation. Dominic, you got anything more normal for us?
Yes, I do have a more normal recommendation. I've been listening to a lot of music lately, as I always do, but there's one fairly significant change in how I'm listening. For various reasons, I decided it was time to make a slightly momentous move and I cancelled my Spotify subscription. I'm now listening to all my music on a French-based streaming platform called Qobuz.
Okay, this is an interesting thing because we are also moving to what we have been calling Qobuz. Is it Qobuz? I should know this. I'm French.
I looked it up and apparently, yeah, it's Qobuz, but apparently it should be pronounced Qobuz. It's an instrument.
Mm. Oh, well, so how is it? Because I've literally been planning this based on my friend saying you should do this. You're now friend number two doing it. Is it good?
Yes, it is really good. And I should stress that this is not sponsored content, although if anyone at Qobuz is listening and would like to place an ad on the Europeans, please be my guest.
Hi.
But yeah, it works really well. It's just as good as Spotify. I don't miss Spotify at all. And just to say this up front, I really don't want to come across as if I'm criticizing anyone who is still using Spotify. I do have some beef with Spotify, but I do not have beef with Spotify users. You should all do you.
Mm-hmm. And what is your beef with Spotify? What was like the motivating factor that made you cross?
Well, yeah, it's a good question, because on the plus side, Spotify is a European tech giant, one of the few, which I do instinctively like. It was founded in Stockholm, although it's now legally based in Luxembourg for reasons one can only imagine. But my main issue is that Spotify pays artists very badly, worse than almost all of its competitors, from what I've seen. I actually came across an Instagram post from a musician that compared all the different music streaming platforms in various different ways, and I was shocked by how low Spotify's per stream payments are. That same post also flagged which platforms have donated to Trump via his inauguration or campaign, and which ones host ads from ICE in the US. So yeah, there's a whole constellation of red flags, because Spotify had green ticks under both those categories. I can share a link in the show notes to that Instagram post if anyone else wants to do that comparison themselves. So I ended up using Qobuz partly because they pay artists significantly more, somewhere in the region of 3 to 6 times more per stream than Spotify. What had held me back before was the thought of losing all my playlists, but they actually have a service that lets you transfer everything over with just a few clicks.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It's so simple. And it is slightly more expensive than Spotify, like by a euro or two extra per month. But for me, that feels like a reasonable bit of extra money to spend if it means that artists are actually getting paid more.
I mean, it does make sense that if you pay the artist more, then the price will go up.
Right.
Yeah, that's true, although I wonder how much Spotify are just keeping its profit. Anyway, have a think about it. I'm happy with the decision I made. It doesn't have a library of podcasts like Spotify. So if you're a...
That was my big question.
Yeah, if you're a Spotify podcast listener, you'd have to go somewhere like Pocket Cast, Castbox, or Podbean. Actually, we have loads of new listeners from Castbox. Hi, Castbox, because we got featured there. Hope you're all doing well.
Hello.
Hi, Castbox people.
Anyway, give it a go. I'm going to try and gradually move more towards European-based and more ethically run tech companies over this year. It's another of my New Year's resolutions, along with being clear and direct. Let's see how far I get. I'm taking baby steps. For my happy ending, I'm taking us to the Czech Republic, where a new decree came into force at the start of this year, meaning that every primary and secondary school has to provide free menstrual products in at least half of their bathrooms. This nationwide scheme follows various regional initiatives in the Czech Republic, and it will go some way towards helping the problem of period poverty. But it's more than that, actually. It's a glimpse of light that it's possible to change the culture around how we treat menstruation in society. Many people believe that sanitary pads, tampons, and the like should be as readily available as toilet paper. And I have to say, I agree. It's not like women choose to menstruate. It's a natural phenomenon that roughly half of the human population experiences. Why should this half of the population have an extra financial burden because of their periods?
My thoughts entirely, Dominic.
We agree.
Good. Anyway, this is good news that will hopefully create less stress, pressure, or anxiety around menstruation for school kids in the Czech Republic. And it's not even that expensive. According to the former Czech health minister who brought this bill in, it should cost the equivalent of around 900 euros for primary schools each year to fund and 1100 euros for secondary schools. Not really that much when you think about their overall budgets. And it's worth pointing out that the Czech Republic isn't the first country with a scheme like this. Scotland and Catalonia have two of the most wide-ranging initiatives, actually more wide-ranging than this one. So well done to the Czech Republic for joining this growing movement for free period products.
Great.
It's amazing how much that conversation has changed in our lifetimes.
It really is.
Yeah.
We will be back next week. I really want this podcast to be a source of comfort in uncertain times, a port in a storm. But having said that, we are going to be releasing next week's podcast on Friday rather than Thursday, right?
Yeah, sorry, that's my fault.
We are rolling with these tumultuous times. Blame Dominic's singing schedule. This week's podcast was produced by Kat Slazlo in Sicily. Thanks, Kat.
Yay.
And Morgan Charles in Prague. Thanks, Morgan. Until next Friday's podcast, come and catch us on the internet. We are on Instagram, Blue Sky, YouTube, and Europe's very own Mastodon. And we have a fantastic new weekly newsletter called Good Week, Bad Week. You should check it out. The link is in the show notes. We'll be back next week with more attempts to understand the chaos.
Ciao.
Zbohem.
See you then.